This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Nearly one in five black men in their 20s in Baltimore is incarcerated. That's according to a 2005 study from the Justice Policy Institute. What effect does that have on the city's neighborhoods? How does it affect a neighborhood's health? What's the key to keeping people out of the criminal justice system? Those are some of the questions that will be asked Monday at an all-day symposium on the Johns Hopkins Medical Campus called Squandered Resources, Incarceration, Its Consequences, Costs, and Alternatives. One of the panelists at the symposium will be sociologist Catherine Eden. She's a noted poverty researcher and distinguished professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, first, this symposium is looking at incarceration through the lens of what's called the social determinants of health. And the social determinants are things like where you live or work, your education level, your race, and how those determine our health. You were speaking on a panel about, quote, incarceration prevention and avoidance, close quote. I understand you're part of a team that's been following 150 young people in Baltimore since 1995, and I want to ask you about what you found to be the most important factor keeping them out of the criminal justice system. But before I ask that, tell me about these kids you've been following.
So these kids were all 0 to 7 between 1994 and 1998, their parents were all living in highly distressed Baltimore public housing. And their parents signed up for a housing intervention. Some of them were placed in the experimental group, some in the control group. But putting the experiment aside, these kids are some of the most disadvantaged kids in America. If you've seen any of David Simon's work, these are the kids he purports to be portraying in Homicide and The Wire. They're kids whose parents often struggled with substance abuse. They've often experienced death firsthand. They've been the victims of violence. They've lived for most of their lives in incredibly stressful high-crime neighborhoods. And yet, as they are now 15 to 23 years old, 75 boys and 75 girls. And we really thought that we would see these kids sort of succumb to crime and criminality.
And how many of them have had contact with the criminal justice system?
What's interesting is if you just look at the boys, the numbers are very low for the girls, which we might expect. Mm-hmm. But for the boys, 50% have had not only have they had no contact with the criminal justice system, they have had no involvement in crime. They've really sort of separated themselves, drawn a bright line between themselves and street culture, and really determined to set on a different path. Now, have had some brush with crime. They've been involved. But only about a third to any serious degree. And many of those, by the time they reach 18, have already desisted. So we were so surprised by this story for boys. I mean, you interview these kids, and I mean, we know these kids well. We met them in the mid-90s. We saw them again in 2003, 2004. We were back in 2007, again in 2010, and we've been following them through 2013. So it's been very interesting to watch their unfolding life course. And the question for us is, how do you account for the fact that so many of these kids hold conventional goals and really seem to be actively resisting the kinds of criminal behavior that leads you into the criminal justice system?
That's Catherine Eden here on Maryland Morning on WYPR. She's a poverty researcher, professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and we're talking about young people and what keeps them out of jail. So answer the question you just posed.
Okay. So when we look at these kids' narratives in depth, what we see is that there are several strategies for sort of resisting the street. One is to draw a bright line. You haven't really withdrawn from the street, but you've said to your peers, I'm not about that, I'm about this. So you don't let any drugs into your car. You are known on the street, but you don't buy alcohol or illegally for any of your younger siblings or friends. You let it be known that you're a person that isn't about the street, right? So that's one strategy. But it's a risky strategy, right? Because you're still in the mix. You're still exposing yourself to the street, but you're kind of trying to be in but not of the street. A second strategy, and this is oftentimes practiced by boys who have been caught up, is withdrawal. And this is kind of a tragic response in a way. Marcus, one of our young men, kind of gave up on conventional behavior around the ninth grade when, in the same short span of time, his best friend was murdered by his side when he was walking to the 7-Eleven, and he was the only witness to the crime. And at about the same time, his cousin was standing at a bus stop and ended up being killed by Baltimore police. So he dropped out of school, dealt drugs for a year and a half, but then through a mom who got off of drugs and became a missionary in her church, came back. And so this man's strategy is really one of withdrawal. All of the windows in his house are blocked up, but he still withdraws to his bedroom when he's not at work to separate himself sort of in every possible way from the factors that used to consume him. But there's a third strategy, and this is the hopeful one.
And what is that?
The third strategy is to be about something else. And for our kids that seem to be the most sort of resilient and healthy and the most likely to be able to pursue the mainstream, futures that they envision, these young men have developed an alternative identity, a strong sense that they're about something else. So Bob has fallen in love with Japanese anime. He got involved in a group in school that also is into anime and goth. And so he's began dressing, a really slight black man has begun dressing all in black with chains. And it's just this powerful affront to street culture. He also got involved in community theater. And through a stepfather, he goes to church every Sunday and has a very meaningful relationship with a pastor. He's now engaged and is planning to marry his fiancée in a short time, and they're expecting their first child. So Tony, another one of our young men from Franklintown, had an older sister who actually made it, and a short-term internship where he was delivering supplies to a pharmacy school here in Baltimore. He talked to a couple of pharmacists and became obsessed with the idea of pursuing this goal himself. So on his refrigerator, he has a list of all of his prerequisites he has to complete at Baltimore County Community College so he can then go on to UMBC and pursue his goal. And he's been admitted to UMBC. So everyone in the community knows Tony is not to be messed with because Tony is about something else. And he's protected, by the adults in the community. He is off limits.
Well, I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned, the first strategy you talked about being, on the street but not really of it, you said is risky. I would think this could be risky, too, to sort of flaunt, I've got this other thing going on, I'm not paying attention to what you guys are doing, getting in trouble. That's not my thing. Isn't that risky, too?
You would think so, right? Because in some ways it's really a powerful statement that you disdain the street. Right. But in Tony's case, for example, he's got two older brothers who the street has claimed. And along with his sister, Tamika, who went to college and is now a Baltimore City school teacher, they're all saying to him, don't do this. Stay straight. Be about something.
So why were some of these kids able to create these identities and others weren't?
Well, two things we see in the narrative. One, our youth programs, right? The internship program that Tony was a part of that got him working with the Maryland Red Cross and delivering these supplies to a pharmacy school was just enough to give him a sense that he could be about something. Other kids get involved in community theater, Big Brother, Big Sister, mentoring programs. These are things that we have kind of placed decreasing emphasis on over time. Church youth groups. The other thing we see beyond, sort of youth programming is mentorship. So in Bob's case, he had an elementary school teacher who invited him over for pizza and football during football season. He had a middle school teacher who encouraged him to be on the debate team. He had a stepfather who got him into church, a church he still goes to today. And he had he saw Bob's grace and his talent and his ability to articulate feelings and thoughts, and so got him involved in Afrocentric theater, something that Bob just has just absorbed. But what's interesting is that although some of our kids have stepped into, you know, have kind of fallen into these mentorship relationships, many of our kids are very, very isolated. And given the mistrust that they've developed, in the course of their lives, they've really adopted this what they call an "I do me" ethos. The sense that I do me. You do you. I do me. I don't need you. I'm a completely autonomous individual who can completely rely on myself. Now, this is too much psychological pressure for anyone. None of us can be completely self-reliant and autonomous. But many of these kids, without mentors and without these programs, really feel they have to go it almost entirely alone.
So what should we do about that?
Well, you know, I love the emphasis that we're placing in the public discourse on early childhood education. But sometimes we can be deceived into thinking that by the time kids are teenagers, it's too late to do anything. And I think the optimism and the goodness of these Baltimore youth, these 150 kids who came from the most disadvantaged social origins you can really imagine, should convince us there's more. We know from interventions that happen on the high school level that we can do a tremendous amount to discourage kids from crime, to keep them from committing homicides, to get them through school, to connect them to jobs, to connect them more to children and two-parent families. We have interventions that work. We have experimental evidence that shows hopeful impacts. So I want to redirect our attention in some way. My colleague at Hopkins, who's doing this work with me, Stephanie DeLuca, says, you know, what about the teenagers? Stop talking about the kids. I think we need to talk about the kids and the teenagers. But even if kids have been in very tough experiences as young people and they missed that high-quality preschool, there's still a lot that we can do. And it's oftentimes not that expensive and maybe even right at our fingertips.
Sociologist Catherine Eden. She's a poverty researcher and professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. She'll speak Monday at the third annual symposium on the social determinants of health. The all-day event is called Squandered Resources: Incarceration, Its Consequences, Costs, and Alternatives. Other speakers at the Turner Auditorium on the Johns Hopkins Medical Campus will include Congressman Elijah Cummings, as well as ex-offenders and public health researchers. We've got more information about it, including a link to where you can register to attend at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. For Nathan, Tom Hall, Stephanie Hughes, Matt Purdy, Jamila Kay, and our interns Cassandra Morales and Justina Latimer, thanks for listening to Maryland Morning. Have a great weekend.